Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the latest Supreme Court ruling, as well as the much-anticipated decision on the Obama healthcare reform law. Former White House counsel and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States, John Dean, joins us. A best-selling author, his latest book is Broken Government: How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. Then we'll look into the president's energy tour and his visit today to Cushing, Oklahoma, where the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline he just approved begins. Jamie Henn, the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org, joins us. He and Bill McKibben have been leading the fight to stop the Keystone pipeline that will carry oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas. Then an expert on terrorists, Mia Bloom, joins us to examine the methods and motivation of the alleged Al-Qaeda French Algerian terrorist who killed three children, a rabbi, and three paratroopers and was shot dead today by a police sniper after wounding three police officers. Mia Bloom is the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, and Bombshell, Women and Terror. And joining us now is John Dean, who is the former counsel to Richard Nixon, and prior to that was the chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of the Law Reform Commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author who writes on the law, government, and politics. His latest book is Broken Government: How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dean.
Ian, it's good to be with you.
And John, this ruling that came down yesterday from the Supreme Court, allowing criminal defendants or granting criminal defendants a constitutional right to effective lawyers during plea negotiations, given that now in federal courts, plea negotiations comprise 90% of all convictions. And in 2006, the last year of for which data was available, the corresponding percentage in state courts is 94%. So I'm surprised that that the four people voted against it, because it seems to be an acknowledgement of reality.
You shouldn't be surprised at that four holding the line for prosecutors, the four being obviously the right wing of the court. And the swing vote, Kennedy obviously shows he has a conscience, because the plea bargaining phase has become the end of the route. And there, as the court pointed out, there are many instances when representation is less than adequate for that phase of the proceeding. While there certainly, a judge can observe what's happening in a courtroom and see a lawyer who's not doing a good job for his client. In the plea bargaining phase, there's no lawyer there or judge there, just the lawyers and the prosecutors hashing it out. And they have some pretty egregious examples in the opinion that led them to the decision they reached.
Well, Justice Kennedy wrote that plea bargaining is not some adjunct to the criminal justice system. It is the criminal justice system. I mean, that the percentage of 97% in federal courts and 94% in state courts, that's the de facto reality.
What prosecutors do is they stack up as much they can in an indictment to try to tell the potential defendant that that's what they're going to do. They're going to charge him with this, that, and everything else. To try to force him into that plea situation. They don't want to go to court on these charges. And so they the way they fashion indictments, where you take one activity and apply a number of statutes to it, you can really make it pretty uncomfortable for that defendant. And so this is often the best of a bad world for somebody who's broken the law, giving all of the power, if you will, to the prosecutors in this negotiating process.
So then why do you think the conservatives objected to it if they're so pro-prosecutor?
No, they did. They didn't object. Scalia and Thomas and the chief and the rest of them were all, and they didn't like this decision. They voted against changing the law. They thought the plea negotiations should just, the prosecutors should have at it. They don't like the change that Kennedy's vote swung over to the other way, saying that there should be representation at this phase and good representation.
Oh, I see. Because that's what the understanding is, that it's really about how so often the councils don't. This is if all of the decisions are done through plea bargaining and not through a trial, then the plea bargaining itself is the critical point for a defense attorney to be present.
It is the beginning, middle, and end for 97% in the federal system and 94% in the state system. So it's the game, and the game never changes.
So my thought was that perhaps that Scalia and Thomas and Alito and Roberts were sort of ideologues living in a kind of ivory tower. But you're saying no, they actually liked the system before this rule came down yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it favored the prosecutors
Scalia says you've created a whole new jurisprudence of plea bargaining. And he says, you know, we've just opened a Pandora's box, as he sees it. There will be endless litigation on this issue. He's probably right. But it's also the fair way to deal with a process that really there has been egregious misuse by prosecutors. And seldom does it, you know, it's a tough game they play. They want to keep criminals off the street. When they get them, they throw the book at them. And it's not a terribly fair proceeding. It certainly doesn't have any of the checks and balances you have when you have a full trial.
But isn't it true that because the Republicans have controlled the executive branch for more time than the Democrats have in the recent decades, that they've managed to put more conservative judges on the federal bench at all levels, and that in general, the judiciary in this country is more conservative than it is, in quotes, liberal?
You're absolutely right, Ian. And not only have they done it, they've made it a priority. They've made it something that's very important. Their congressional arm does their best to block Democrats from filling judicial appointments. And then they hit, you know, I was surprised that Obama, when he arrived, wasn't more ready for this. Republicans, typically by the time they arrive in the White House, boy, they've got their list going and they hit the ground running. That hasn't been the case with the Obama administration, and they've had other priorities, so they've let a lot of this obstructionism in this area prevail as well. The Democrats are obviously hoping that they will have a president get reelected, and they'll be able to fill some of the vacancies. There's a conspicuous number of vacancies in courts right now in the federal system because of this obstructionism.
Well, it's not just a question, though, John Dean, of President Obama getting reelected. The Democrats would have to pick up a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate to move all of those blocked federal judgeships.
Well, theoretically, they still haven't put. There is really no agreement that you can filibuster a nomination and a presidential appointment. This is considered part of the executive calendar of the Senate. And while there have been filibusters, and we had some pretty near calls on it in the past, it's more stalling techniques, less than a filibuster.
Right, the holds,
The holds, and it's just pure obstructionism to tie the process up, to not report it out of committee, to tie it up at every phase. To prevent the Republican or prevent a Democratic president from balancing that bench, but you know, if just sheer time with the turnover in the federal system, the federal court system, a Democratic president will be able to balance it out. So that you know, if a man gets a 4-year term, it's close. He can't do a whole lot, and certainly not the last year. The obstructionism will even raise higher. But if Obama gets 8 years. He'll have a chance to balance out the federal judiciary, and it is out of balance right now. Bush did a good job of loving the court and tilting it to the right.
Again, I'm speaking with John Dean, who's a former counsel to President Richard Nixon. And prior to that, he was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and associate director of the Law Reform Commission and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. He's a best-selling author. His latest book is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative and Judicial Branches. So the big anticipation, of course, is the ruling on the constitutionality of President Obama's health care reform law. The part that I don't understand is how it could be an issue and why people are, the pundits are saying this could totally gut the president's singular achievement, legislative achievement here, because on the basis of the mandate. But if you really look at the text of this bill, apparently, people are encouraged, shall we say, to have insurance. But there really aren't any penalties. There are no enforceable penalties.
There's nominal cash.
Yeah, no liens or anything like that. No. So couldn't you make the argument that it's really not an enforced mandate?
Well, there will be a preliminary argument as to whether it is a tax or not, and even whether it's appealable at this point, because the tax, you cannot, in essence, there's law that says you can't contest a tax until it's actually imposed. So if they rule it's a tax, or the equivalent of a tax, and it's not been imposed, there's an argument that it's not even ripe for consideration by the high court. That'll be one of the issues that the court will address, because they put it on the agenda. But there are lots of other issues. It's very interesting. I have a number of column colleagues at Justia, where we write now.
Oh, tell me that website, because I want to...
It's justia.com.
J-U-S-T-I-A.com.
Right.
Okay.
And the section is verdict. It's typically the column of the day is put on the front page, and that'll take you back to the verdict section. That's what they call the section where we do our columns. Anyway, a number of those, my co-columnists, are former Supreme Court law clerks who really follow the tea leaves very closely of that court. And off the record, they tell me they believe that Obama's going to prevail, that the court will not overturn it. And they understand and watch these issues and their nuances much more closely than I do. Which I found very interesting. In fact, one of them told me he saw a possibility of only one vote against the president. It could be an 8-1, but he said for political reasons alone that might not happen. But he thinks that at least 6-3 is a very realistic vote on upholding the Obamacare law.
Well, you get the impression that Mitt Romney's kind of counting on it, huh? But
his life will be easier if he's got theoretically the same parallel from his days in Massachusetts.
Oh, of course.
One of his finest accomplishments as governor, he has to run away from.
Absolutely,
nomination.
Yeah. So let me ask you then about, you just mentioned the Supreme Court clerks. I recently did a UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, and Lawrence Lessig, the law professor from Harvard, was our guest, and he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And I asked him about what he thought was going to happen with Citizens United and whether this Montana case could, because a couple of the justices, I think Ginsburg and Breyer, suggested that this might be an opportunity to revisit Citizens United. And Lawrence Lessig thought it could be actually quietly overturned.
I agree with that. I appreciated that in your note to me, I think Lessig is right on. I've been writing and tweeting about that Montana case since it first broke. It was ignored by the mainstream for almost a week or better when it came out, and I read it with fascination. They make a very compelling case that at least Montana's an exception. They looked right square at Citizens United, said, hey, doesn't apply. So they've pried a little hole through which the camel not only has his nose but might get his whole body in the tent. So I think Lessig is right. Incidentally, your listeners want to follow my Twitter account. It's at John W. Dean.
At John.
All are welcome.
Well, the logic of overturning it, I mean, listen, my understanding is that, of course, it will be the vote of again the vote that prevailed in the case that we started talking about today, Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Yeah, he's a swing vote. He actually is. It's a one man court right now.
It's a one man court, right? So my understanding is that at least this is what Lawrence Lessig told me. He said that he thinks that first of all, I asked him what were they thinking? Because remember, when the president in the State of the Union castigated the court. Alito mouthed, you're wrong or not true. I think not true was the words. What were they thinking? And I guess the idea is that somehow they were equating the rights of a documentary filmmaker and vast and powerful corporations. And now the evidence is so manifest that is completely out of balance, even if they were motivated by their sort of purity over the First Amendment. He felt that the evidence is so manifest out there that the four conservatives may not, they're pretty rigid, but Kennedy may literally recognize reality.
Yeah, I think there is a real possibility of that. And what's interesting is if you recall the debate we had at your forum on Citizens United at the time it was handed down, I predicted exactly what's happening would happen, as most of the people who weren't idealistically ideologues on this issue had to agree that unlimited corporate funds were on their way in. And I said the first year they will hide and they will very low profile it. Then the next time year round, they're coming in because once they understand the playing field, like you've never seen them before, and here they are. And it's totally distorting American politics. I mean, the amount of money that's going to be raised in this presidential election is just unseemly.
Well, it seems like it it could determine the outcome just by sheer volume, and there doesn't seem to be any limit to the sheer volume.
No, it could well. Obama's had found himself, as much as he dislikes Citizens United and the unregulated PACs that they're able to create, he's got to do it to play the game, or he will be outspent and the office will be perched right out from underneath him.
Well, he's at a disadvantage because there's an awful lot more jaundiced billionaires than there are idealistic ones.
Well, fortunately, there's some idealistic millionaires around, too. There are a lot more people who will pony up a couple dollars that will support Obama than Romney or he being the most likely can garner.
Well, with the two big pockets billionaires, the guy that owns Progressive Insurance and George Soros have both said this time around they're sitting it out, so... We can see how much money is pouring in, and even into Gingrich and Santorum, let alone when they finally choose somebody.
It is ugly out there.
And this is only the primary, so the general, you'd have to assume that infinitely more money is going to pour in.
It's going to be a $1 billion election.
Wow. So John Dean, in terms of this election, though, a lot of pundits are saying, particularly when, I think it's less likely now that Santorum will be able to, maybe he could last through California, but it seems more and more likely that Romney will eventually become the nominee, albeit not without some bruising to the party. The analogy, though, that's often used is that this could be another Goldwater convention like the 64 blowout.
Well, if Romney didn't move to the center, if he gets the nomination, then you'd see that situation. Romney will flip-flop whichever direction he smells the wind or feels the wind blowing, and he'll try to get in front of it. Santorum, however, who I do not believe will get the nomination, and certainly not Gingrich, that would be a potential Goldwater redo, like 64. And, I think it would be the greatest thing for Obama. It would certainly ease his pain, because Romney will run to the center as soon as he gets the nomination, whereas Santorum would not. And it'd be a very real test of what kind of power conservatism has. I don't think it, you know, I don't think that it can really generate much more than 40-50% most. But you're going to need more than that to, I'd say 40% most, really, of the voters. And that's a lot of them holding their nose to just support the party.
Well, but that's just in closing. The what is the party now? It's so, moved so far to the right that traditional Republicans like yourself are you know an extinct species.
Well, we're not Republicans.
Right. So where's your home? Where do you go?
We're independent. We have none, but we control who wins.
I see. I said, well, we better stay in touch then.
we're like Kennedy on the court. We're the swing vote.
Right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Dean.
Thanks, Ian.
Great. Bye. Again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who's the former counsel to Richard Nixon, and prior to that, he was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of the Law Reform Commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, he's a best-selling author who writes on the law, government, and politics, and Justia, I think is the name of his column, justia.com. His latest book is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive Branch, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with one of the key people who has been fighting the good fight against the Keystone XL pipeline.
Sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand, no, just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jamie Henn, who's the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org, an environmental organization leading the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Keystone XL Zombie Rises. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Henn.
Good to be with you.
And the president visited Cushing, Oklahoma today, where the southern leg of the pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline, which he just approved, is supposed to begin. There are some immediate questions now about the very nature of this decision and whether or not this will basically have nothing to do. This, in fact, may end up raising the price of gas for American consumers, even though it's being sold in the drill baby drill sphere as lowering the price, because isn't it an open invitation for exporting American oil products? And already American oil products are the largest export commodity in the U.S.
Yeah, no, well, you brought up a lot of really good points there. You know, this pipeline has kind of been a scam from the start. So it's not surprising to see that we have a lot of propaganda out there about how it will lower gas prices and be good for America, when really this is a pipeline designed to take dirty tar sands oil, some of the dirtiest fuel on the planet from Canada, run it right through America's heartland over some of our most sensitive sources of fresh water, some of our best agricultural land in the country, ship it down to Gulf Coast refineries, and get it out for export. So it's a shame to see that the president has kind of been forced to adopt a bit of this and was there in Cushing today, standing in TransCanada's pipeline yard, talking about expediting the southern half of this pipeline. Now, it's important to remember that the pipeline's kind of in two parts. There's one that comes down from Canada, bringing the tar sands to Cushing, Oklahoma, and then a second pipeline that would run from Cushing down to the Gulf Coast. When TransCanada initially applied for a permit from the State Department to approve this Keystone XL pipeline that we've all been fighting, they tied those two pipelines together to make it one big project. But they really never needed a federal permit for that bottom half. So that's one of the reasons why the president is out there saying that he's going to help expedite it, because really he doesn't have much to do with it. So that pipeline's going to go forward either way, except for, of course, the fact that landowners along the route and national environmental groups are promising to give it as much opposition as it can. So, you know, this has been a long saga, as I was writing about. You know, this zombie keeps coming back no matter what we do. So today was certainly a disappointment, but by no means does it mean that the full Keystone XL pipeline has been approved, that the work that everybody has done has gone to naught. I think, if anything, it's shown people that we're going to have to keep the pressure up on this president. We can't back down.
Well, the new Gallup poll released today ahead of President Obama's speech in Cushing, Oklahoma, announcing the Keystone XL pipeline, says it's 57% of Americans support building the entire Keystone XL pipeline, with 29% opposed. So it looks like the drill baby drill mantra has worked.
Well, it has to a certain extent. You know, there's some new things. There's been a lot of polls that have floated around, and this Gallup one that just came out was very much timed to kind of coincide with the president's arrival. One of the things that people leave out of the polling is really mentioning what sort of oil is flowing through the pipeline. I think Americans right now are feeling the pain at the pump. It's not surprising that a lot of Americans want more gasoline. What we need to know is that this pipeline does not carry regular crude. It's carrying this dirty, corrosive, dangerous tar sands oil that not only causes immense environmental destruction in Canada and leads to very high global warming emissions, but also is really bad for the pipelines themselves. The previous Keystone pipeline that was running tar sands fuel leaked 12 times last year in its first year of operation. So the promises we're receiving that this pipeline won't have any problems are, again, a pretty large scam. And I think the more the American people know about this, the more they'll realize that this is really meant to enrich big oil and not bring more product to the consumer. Of course, it's hard to get the word out, which is great why we have stations like yourselves and others who are trying to get the truth out about what's going on here. And, you know, I think that among people that have gotten that, they're very active and fired up. And you'll continue to see a really vocal opposition, not only from environmentalists, but from ranchers and landowners, and especially young people that have really risen up to fight this project.
Again, I'm speaking with Jamie Hand, who's the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org, an environmental organization leading the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. He has an article at the Huffington Post, "The Keystone XL Zombie Rises." I think a lot of the information about what's happening now in Canada is so damning that should be a huge wake-up call for anybody. The very environmental price that's being paid just to separate the oil from the sands up there means that you have to heat up water to a tremendous pressure in these hoses that separate the tar from the sand, and then all that brackish oil polluted water goes off into these vast ponds where it's stored forever. And I talked to Bill McKibben a while back about it, and he's flown over this area, and he said it looks like Mordor from the sort of dystopian world, you know. That's just going to get worse exponentially. And my understanding is, I've talked to some Canadian environmental experts, and they say that at a certain point, the Canadians are going to wake up and realize that the water that they're destroying is more valuable than the oil that they're getting out.
No, that's exactly right. You know, this is an environmental travesty of epic proportions. And if your listeners have a chance to Google just tar sands, you'll see these photos, and they really are shocking. It does look like Mordor. And I think, you know, this is a symptom of what we're seeing around the world right now, that as we've run out of the cheap, easy oil and resources we need to go for, we're starting to see all of these extreme energy projects where, as you described, we literally have to, you know, strip mine and boil the earth to get oil out. But that's not just happening in the tar sands. We're seeing that with mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia, and we're seeing it with fracking in a lot of places, from California to Colorado to Ohio to, of course, places like Pennsylvania and New York. So I think more and more Americans are realizing that we're really at a crossroads. We can either go down the route of this extreme energy future where we're going to be seeing drilling rigs in our backyards and a lot of big new projects like Keystone XL that really only enrich the corporations that are putting a lot of money into supporting them, or we can really begin to choose clean energy and run in that direction hard. But we need to make a choice, and that's why I think it's disappointing to see President Obama saying he has this all-of-the-above type of energy approach. You know, Bill McKibben, you know, you can't kind of drink six martinis at lunch and then have a vitamin water after and say you're not going to be drunk. You know, you kind of need to make some choices here, and we need the president to really commit to clean energy and stop kind of siding with the big polluters on these issues.
So why do you think that, given that the president is obviously on the defensive because of the price of oil, some time back, John Boehner, the leader of the House, told the Republicans that the price of gas is going to be the best issue we can run on this year. You can see how it is working out that way, both in the presidential campaigns and in the forthcoming House and Senate campaigns. So you would think, and I've been doing some investigations into it for some time now, and some of the people who actually know about the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, one of the former heads of it, and one of the leading analysts of oil of the oil and gas markets, Fidel Guite, they've made it really clear that at least 30% of the price of gas today is a result of speculation on Wall Street. On the commodities market, by mostly the Goldman Sachs and the big banks, who own about 80 to 90% of all the futures contracts, not the oil companies and the truckers and the refineries that would normally need to secure a reliable supply, which is the basic rationale for a futures market. So the market's completely distorted. The pain at the pump, a third of what people are paying is totally going to these parasites on Wall Street. And the president is completely silent on this. You'd think that that would be a winning issue, given that most Americans have figured out that they got hosed in 2008 when they bailed out Wall Street.
Right. No, I completely agree. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head with this one. You know, some interesting polling is out there, and this is the other poll that, you know, needs to be circulated in some ways, of who Americans blame for high gas prices when they do get angry about it. And there isn't really a consistency there. You know, people do not kind of blame the president overwhelmingly. In fact, a lot of Americans already, without the information you were mentioning, blame big oil. They understand that these corporations are standing to make more money than any corporations in the history of money, that they're speculating, that they're taking the profits that they have and buying back their own stock to further enrich themselves, and importantly, that they're getting billions and billions of dollars, some estimates up to $40 billion a year, from the American taxpayer in the form of subsidies and handouts and tax breaks as well. So it really is. I mean, they have this system rigged, and no more so than in Washington, D.C., where they've given so many campaign contributions and spent so many lobbying dollars that you have Congress not even really willing to talk about the issue in an appropriate way, and going on the warpath around gas prices like this as the Republicans are doing. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think for our work going forward, we're looking at Keystone XL. We will keep this fight going on. We'll be supporting landowners along the route who are resisting the project, but also really trying to expand this fight and go on the offensive around the dirty energy money that's in politics and these fossil fuel subsidies that are really distorting the markets in a way and blocking the types of solutions that we need to finally break this addiction to oil. And again, in the ultimate long run, really start dropping prices for consumers when they have access to clean, affordable, renewable energy.
But my understanding is that the big oil companies, Exxon and others, have tried to point out that they're not responsible for the price of oil. There's a global glut. The demand is down, both globally and nationally. And as I was saying earlier, one of the criticisms of this this XL pipeline that's the president's just approved is that that it will allow for more and more exports of refined products, and the U.S. is now the largest export commodity in the United States. So we're exporting more oil and refined products than ever. And the president said that demand is lower than it's ever been for decades or so. So there's a huge disconnect here. I just don't understand how the drill baby drill stuff works in the evidence when the evidence is so clear. You got tons of oil, lots of supply, and normally in market economics, when you have an abundance of supply, then the price has dropped. Yet the opposite is happening. So there has to be another explanation, and the explanation is those predators on Wall Street.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You know, and the volatility of the international oil market, which does have a factor. You know, again, President Obama laid it out himself when he was talking out of the clean energy side of his mouth, as opposed to the drill baby drill side, by saying it pretty clearly. You know, we have 2% of the world's oil reserves, and we consume 20% of the world's oil. There's no way to make that equation work, you know, for the long term. And we're going to need to find alternatives. And the president should be commended on his moves to strengthen fuel efficiency standards and make some of those other processes that the government has gotten into place. But the fact remains, you know, this is going to be a fight. The big oil companies and the fossil fuel companies are not going to stop trying to make a profit here. And until we can really begin to limit their power in Washington and get at things like these subsidies, I think you'll continue to see this kind of misinformation get out there so that, as you can say, they can continue to speculate, continue to make record profits, and continue to kind of misinform the American people about what really is the situation in our energy economy. You know, it would be nice if our president would get up there with a few quick slides or, you know, just use his amazing rhetorical abilities to try and explain this to people. But it looks like he's not willing to have that kind of brave approach or that principled approach to running this year. So we're going to do our best to keep pushing him on it. And we saw that just today after President Obama appeared in Cushing, Oklahoma. His next stop was at Columbus, in Columbus, Ohio, at Ohio State University. And, you know, he was met by a lot of protesters there who were angry about Keystone, angry about fracking, angry about the oil industry. You know, those are students who worked for President Obama in 2008. You know, now they're out there protesting him because they feel like they need to put their energies elsewhere. So, you know, we're going to keep pushing the president, but it really is time that someone and some of our political leaders get those facts out there that you were mentioning.
Well, we wouldn't be having this conversation, Jamie Henn, if we had huge investments in public transportation and huge investments in they're starting to happen in the automobile industry and the changing over to hybrids and to battery powered cars, and the president's touting that a lot. But it's, you know, I'm astounded at how that, even though it's happening, that I don't feel that there's a huge kind of push behind it like there was to put a man on the moon or something like that. I mean, in fact, in many ways, you know, you get very depressed when stories come out about the new Chevy Volt catching on fire, which turned out to be a completely overblown story. Is there this atavistic kind of conspiracy out there to keep us hooked on this drug forever?
Well, I think it's not even too much of a conspiracy. I mean, these companies make huge profits from keeping us hooked. So just like any good drug dealer, they're going to do everything they can to keep us out of rehab. You know, we have the technological solutions, as you said. I'm actually in Colorado right now, and just the other day toured the National Renewable Energy Lab, which is government funded. And they're doing amazing research. You know, they're getting their funding slashed by Republicans in Congress. But these are scientists who are making amazing breakthroughs in thin film solar technologies and new types of wind turbines and more efficient engines. We're making the technology work, but we need to accelerate that process, and then we need to begin to deploy it. But we're not going to be able to send those market signals until we really end the perversities in the market like subsidies, and also begin to really go after that ultimate subsidy that these companies enjoy, which is the right to just pollute our atmosphere for free. You know, your average restaurant can't just toss all of its garbage in the street and wait for the rats to come. And ExxonMobil shouldn't be able to toss all of its carbon into our atmosphere and make us live with the global warming impacts of that and the health impacts that come from pollution as well. So I think, you know, that's the core of this issue. And as you mentioned, with Occupy out there, with the Keystone XL protests, we're beginning to see a movement that I think is connecting the dots between these local struggles, these policy issues, and the, you know, iconic fights that we need to really fire people up. So, you know, I go back and forth between kind of being really downtrodden and feeling like we're not making progress, and then looking at all the momentum that there is around the country to take this on, to feeling like we might just have a chance this year to begin to tie this together into something that begins to set the national agenda in a different direction.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jamie Henn.
Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Jamie Henn, who's the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org, an environmental organization leading the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. He has an article at the Huffington Post, "The Keystone XL Zombie Rises." We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with an expert on terrorism, but more importantly, terrorists. We've been going to do a profile as much as we can on the French terrorist. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mia Bloom, a professor of Women's Studies and International Studies at Pennsylvania State University and a fellow at the International Center for the Study of Terrorism. She has advanced degrees in both Arab and Russian studies and speaks eight languages. She's the author of the critically acclaimed book Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. Her latest book is Bombshell, Women and Terror, and she's currently completing a book called Gendercide, The Strategic Logic of Rape During War, and is looking into the increasing role of the use of children in terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mia Bloom.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And clearly the French Algerian who was killed today by a police sniper, apparently he had they'd thrown a bunch of stun grenades into the apartment. He'd been holed up in for 32 hours or something. And then the police came in and they were met with a barrage of fire from him. Three police were wounded. And then he tried to get out the back window and was shot by a police sniper. I think he was still firing as he went out the back window. But what I think is extraordinary about this story is the brutality of this man, that he shot those young kids, those eight-year-old girls, right up. He literally put the gun right up to their head and shot them at point-blank range. And he's saying he's doing that in the name of the Palestinian children. I mean, that's pretty hard to take, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think part of what we're seeing is all of a sudden now a number of groups are trying to claim responsibility for Marat. And they're saying, oh, he was one of us. And so I think part of what we're seeing is a media circus going on, not just to try to ascertain what motivated him, but also within the jihadi world, who gets to claim responsibility, who gets to link up with him after the fact. But who
would want to, though, Mia? Why would anybody want to be associated with that such wanton cruelty towards innocent children?
Well, what they do is very often, and it's one of the reasons why you see in the pre-attack videos, let's say for a suicide bomber, you'll see the logo of the organization in the background. You'll see some post-production to the video as well, making sure you've got the logo several times throughout the video to ensure that the group that did it actually gets, quote-unquote, credit. Because we've had a number of instances when as many as four different groups would try to claim responsibility for an attack, because from their perspective, this shows that the group is proactive, it gets them on the radar screen, and within the jihadi world, they can get credit. But at the same time, we're also seeing different divisions within the jihadi and Salafi world with regard to children. It could be that attacking children is going too far. The reaction after the Beslan attacks, for instance, in Russia, were very negative, and even some of the terrorist groups now have voiced their opposition to Marat's attack in Toulouse. So I think we're going to see different interpretations and as well as different reactions to this horrible attack.
And which groups have distanced themselves from Marat's attack, killings?
Interestingly enough, a number of the Palestinian groups and the Palestinian Authority itself has come out against Marat's attack. But the group that is allegedly part of AQIM in the Maghreb, an al-Qaeda affiliate called Jund al-Khalifa, has said now that Marat was one of theirs. Another group in France, Force Annalisa, Knights of Glory, has also claimed affiliation with Marat and his brother. So we're seeing the differences emerge now over this one attack.
Well, but the Palestinian Authority is not a terrorist group. What about Hamas? What have they responded?
Hamas has, depending on who you speak to, Hamas has voiced opposition to the attack, although, again, part of the problem is, as we're getting these reports, we're getting really contradictory information. So, in general, you could make an argument that no matter what you think about the underlying motivations and grievances of the different groups, attacking children is going too far. But there are some people that will come forward and say, well, no, if this is a defensive jihad, if this is a jihad in which Islam is being attacked from all around, then women can get involved and children can get involved, and no one is immune.
Well, what do you know, Mia Bloom, about Marat's brother? Abdel Qaeda. I mean, he supposedly was running an underground railroad for jihadis going to fight the Americans in Iraq.
Yeah, so he was involved in internet recruitment. And we see a lot of this in Europe, whether it's in Belgium with a woman who's been arrested, Malika Arud, in Italy, Barbara Farina. There's been a number of internet-based jihadis whose role it is to use propaganda and to try to get people to go to Iraq on the jihad or to Afghanistan. And a lot of times, the websites use language that talk about the need to defend Muslim women, that their sisters in Islam are being attacked, they're being raped by U.S. and British and NATO soldiers, and that the men need to step up and go to these countries to protect their sisters, otherwise they're not manly and they're not doing their duty.
Well, apparently Mohammed Merah went twice to Afghanistan and Pakistan in November of 2010 and in August of 2011. And on his return from Pakistan on the second trip, he was called into questioning by French intelligence agencies. Since you study both terrorism and terrorists, Mia Bloom, what's your sense of how the French are handling this? It would seem to me the DCRI is the relevant agency, I guess the equivalent of the FBI. But it would seem to me that this wouldn't. I'd find it hard to believe that this could ever happen in America. That I could believe the part that a jihadi, if that's indeed what he is, could get weapons. We know that you can buy weapons. In fact, I think one of Al-Qaeda's handbooks, they said, you know, don't bring weapons into America. You can buy them easily at gun stores. He had body armor. Those things, I think, are hard to get in France. That's another question I have. But do you think, give me your sense of a comparison between how the U.S. would have handled this and how the French appear to have handled this?
Well, I mean, you could make a comparison between Merah and Faisal Shahzad, who was a Times Square bomber, in terms of this notion of going to other countries and getting training and still being under the radar screen. I think when Merah was called in, at least from the reports that I've seen, he made claims that he was just there as a tourist and provided photos that, you know, he was going to various places and taking vacation photos.
And to get a wife, apparently, too. He said he was going to get a wife.
He was looking for a wife, which may or may not be sort of the thing to do, although one would imagine it would make more sense had he gone to Morocco or Algeria to find a wife there. But they believed him. And we can take this, we can interpret this in two ways. One, as we can question whether or not the French security forces dropped the ball, whether they missed something. Or maybe another way of looking at it is, here you have someone who is clearly disturbed, someone who has definite mental issues, and perhaps we are making these linkages after the fact because he himself wanted to make himself bigger than he actually was. He was basically a juvenile delinquent. He'd been arrested 15 times, all for petty crimes. I mean, he wasn't a really big fish in all of this. And yet, you know, if he's making these linkages to Al-Qaeda, that makes him much more important after the fact.
And but there's still a lot of things. Well, let me ask you about the other question I raised, though, about how did this guy get all this heavy weaponry and body armor?
This is actually something that has not been adequately reported. It's been reported on some news sources that he brought them back from the regions, and other news sources that he was acquiring them more locally. So I don't honestly know. There is something interesting that did come up. Apparently, 2 hours before the siege started, someone, maybe Merah, made a phone call to France news agency, their equivalent of CNN, which is called France 24, and spoke for 11 minutes to their senior news editor, Abba Kalando. Apparently, in the conversation with Kalando, the person, who may or may not have been Merah, gave detailed information about videotaping the murders, how many guns he used, whether he lost cartridges, how many bullets he'd actually used. So we have some information potentially as a result of that phone call. But in that phone call, again, Kalando says he was very calm, very collected. He made his points, but he didn't sound like an insane person. Yet most people who are lone actors, most people who are engaging in activities like this, definitely there's something wrong with them. and they are really desperate individuals in need of help.
Well, this is after, this happened Tuesday night, this is after this person had shot those young girls in the head at point-blank range, these 3 8-year-old girls.
Well, there were 2 boys and a little girl. But
one
of the things that hasn't been reported very, very well has been the majority of the paratroopers that he killed at the outset, you know, because he started his killing spree on the 11th. 3 of the 4 paratroopers he killed were also North African. 2 were Muslim, 1 was Christian. And again, so here he is, allegedly a jihadi, killing other Muslims who happen to be in the French military. And again, if you go by the strictest interpretation of the Quran, you're not supposed to kill other Muslims, you're not supposed to kill civilians, you're definitely not supposed to kill children. So here he is violating all the major tenets, even of the strictest interpretation of the Salafi ideology.
And he's still claiming to be a member of al-Qaeda, but isn't that the way it works? You know, anybody can claim it. It's an open franchise.
Anyone can claim it, and in fact, sometimes they can claim it. It's not true, but if they engage in an act that gets a lot of attention, and media attention in particular, al-Qaeda may turn around and claim them. Because, you know, it's a freebie for them. They didn't actually have to do anything, and they are able to reap the rewards of the media attention. You know, whether it's al-Qaeda or any other terrorist group all over the world, you know, Maggie Thatcher used to say, the media is the lifeblood of the terrorist organization. Without the media reporting all these events, terrorists would not exist. So, in fact, this is something that feeds the terrorist machine, is having this media attention. So when they engage in brutal activities, killing women, killing children, engaging in suicide bombing against a mosque, these are the things that are going to get them the most attention.
Well, I think your point's well taken, Mia Bloom, that he said, I think whether it was to the police or to this anchor with France 24 television, he said that he was going to bring France to its knees. He certainly didn't bring France to his knees, but in terms of the media, he did in a sense. I mean, it's all about the media, isn't it? It's how much you can capture.
It's definitely about the media, and especially the timing during the course of a French campaign, which has been quite intense and nasty. You can imagine the same thing happening in this country leading up to the next election. These are the kinds of things that every different politician in France is taking a position. And Marine Le Pen, who's the daughter of the senior Le Pen, who is a rabid racist and xenophobe, has capitalized on this attack.
Yeah, she said that Sarkozy has dangerously underestimated the threat of Islamic fundamentalism, and clearly, I talked to a French reporter yesterday about it, about whether it would be a campaign issue, how they handled it. I don't know what the post-mortem is on the handling of this. They were apparently trying to get this guy alive. And I guess they decided it wasn't worth it. After he wounded 3 more police, they must have decided it wasn't worth it, right?
No, actually, no. He had lulled them into a false sense by saying he was going to give himself up. That's how they got into the apartment in the first place.
Oh, I see.
And then as soon as the paratroopers got in, he started shooting like crazy and then emerged from the bathroom window, shooting the gun as he jumped out the windows. And again, people would refer to this as suicide by police. Clearly, he knew this was the end. But he had lied to them, I guess it was about a half an hour before, saying, no, I'm going to give myself up peacefully. They had tried to get his mother to end the siege, and people who knew him, people who were friends with him. And so I think at this point, he had nothing left. So he just thought he would go out, you know, in a blaze of glory.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Mia Bloom.
Ian, thank you so much for having me.
Again, Mia Bloom, Professor of Women's Studies and International Studies at Pennsylvania State University, a fellow at the International Center for the Study of Terrorism. She's the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, and her latest book is Bombshell, Women and Terror. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with John Dean, the former White House counsel to Richard Nixon, the guy that basically put Nixon out of business. He's an expert on the Supreme Court, and we talked about the ruling that came down about plea bargaining, which the conservatives thought was a terrible idea because it somehow ties the hands of prosecutors so they can't con people into plea bargains. And fortunately, the swing vote on the court, Anthony Kennedy, recognized that since 97% of federal cases are plea bargained and 94% of state cases are plea bargained, that this is the new reality and that we have to deal with it. It shows you how ideological the four conservatives are who voted against it, in the sense that they're living in a right-wing fantasy land. And then we talked about the Keystone XL pipeline, the southern part that was approved today or announced today by President Obama in Cushing, Oklahoma. He's on an energy tour around the country. I asked Jamie Henn, who along with Bill McKibben, the founders of 350.org, they've been fighting this pipeline from the beginning. And obviously, you know, the majority of the public in America support this pipeline. They've drunk the drill, baby, drill Kool-Aid. He thinks that there's a way to turn it around, and he's determined to demonstrate and to organize and to get the word out and eventually change people's mind, because he believes the whole thing's a huge scam. It has nothing to do with energy independence. In fact, it's going to probably eventually cause a rise in gas, because it's all about exporting gas, not about domestic consumption. And also I asked him why wasn't the president in this opportunity he has to take on the energy issue, which makes him very vulnerable because of the Republicans are trying to use this as their main issue in this election campaign, why he didn't bring up the issue of the speculation on Wall Street. And I'm afraid Jamie didn't have an answer. It still, frankly, mystifies me. Then we spoke with Mia Bloom, who's an expert on terrorism and terrorists, to try and get a sense of the methods and motivation of this alleged al-Qaeda French Algerian terrorist who'd killed these three children, a rabbi and three paratroopers, who were shot dead today by a police sniper after he'd wounded three more police officers. She talked about how in many ways this has crossed a line in terms of killing children. And a number of terrorist groups around the world have distanced themselves from this guy. At the same time, a whole bunch of them have wanted to join on the bandwagon and put their logo on these videos. And apparently this guy filmed all of the murders of these young children. He shot them right up close, put a gun right up to their head. He was carrying a camera when he did all of this. So I hate to think, I dread the thought of it, but I'm absolutely convinced that this mayhem will end up on television. And after all, the whole thing was a television event. Without the media, the terrorists would be nothing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.